too competitive, then nothing might get built, just as a pair of running elk can lock horns so helplessly that both of them starve. As a result, that year saw the formation of a new super-bureaucratic entity called the California State Federal Interagency Group, William E. Warren, chairman, which immediately issued a call for a Herculean amount of water development, most of it on the undammed rivers of the isolated, rainy North Coast. On a big wall map depicting what they wanted to build, one saw, traced in red, a Dos Rios Reservoir and an English Ridge Reservoir and a Sequoia Reservoir and an Etzel Reservoir and a Panther Reservoir and a Frost Reservoir and a Sebo Reservoir and a Minna Reservoir in the Eel. 8 reservoirs on 3 forks of a middle-sized river that was nearly dry from June to October. And that wasn't all. There was a baseline in Dinsmore Dam on the Van Dusen. There was a Butler Valley, and an Anderson Ford, and an enlarged Ruth Reservoir, a smaller one already existed, on the Mad River. Sounding like the creator himself, Bill Warren, in his introduction to the report, described how the waters had been divided up. The upper main eel above the middle fork, as shown on attached Chart 1, was assigned to the Bureau of Reclamation. The main eel between the middle fork and the south fork was assigned to the Corps of Engineers, the Van Dusen River Basin to the Bureau, the lower eel to the Corps. Nothing was to be built by California itself, though it, of course, would reap the rewards, especially its big growers, who would receive millions of acre-feet of water via long tunnels drilled through the Coast Range. The whole scheme, said Warren in his introductory remarks, represented a new chapter in California's illustrious history of water planning. But it wouldn't quite work out that way. In fact, the feuding agencies were about to lock horns and starve over the first two dams on their priority lists. The North Coast dam that the state and the Corps passionately wanted to build was Dos Rios, a 73-story earth-fill wall across the middle fork of the Eel that would capture twice as much water as Shasta Lake. It would create one of the biggest reservoirs in the West. The dam the Bureau wanted to build first was English Ridge, which would create a smaller reservoir on the main eel a short distance away. Since each project required a hard rock tunnel, about 20 miles long, to shunt the water to where it was allegedly needed, they would both be very expensive. To become economically feasible, a large proportion of their costs would have to be written off to flood control, which is non-reimbursable. The Corps of Engineers has always been vested with the authority to compute the flood control benefits of federal dams. It was, as expected, quite generous in computing the flood control benefits of Dos Rios. It was inexplicably niggardly in the case of English Ridge. David Schuster, who had become the operations manager for the Central Valley Project, and who would later be hounded out of the Bureau for being too fair-minded about Jimmy Carter's water project's hit list, would later insist that English Ridge was a perfectly feasible project. There was nothing wrong with English Ridge, Schuster remembered. A lot of the water could have gone to municipalities in the North Bay and to grape growers. Repayment-wise, it was in sound shape. The thing that killed us was the Corps wouldn't give us the flood control benefits they gave to Dos Rios. It was like they were using two separate formulae. Flood control benefits for both dams, it would turn out, were largely a fraud. Even huge Dos Rios Dam would have reduced the 35-foot crest of the monstrous 1964 flood by less than a foot, a fact which the Corps took pains to camouflage, but which its enemies, especially a local Dartmouth-educated rancher named Richard Wilson, who led the opposition, managed to bring out and make stick. It was Wilson, and Ronald Reagan, who as governor refused to approve the project, who ultimately killed Dos Rios Dam, but it was the infighting between the agencies that set the stage for its defeat, and for the ultimate collapse of the whole carefully orchestrated development push. By 1981, not a single one of the 13 North Coast dams on the Corps' and the Bureau's priority lists had been built. In that year, moreover, all the major North Coast rivers were added to the federal Wild and Scenic Rivers system by the Carter administration, which, in theory, puts them forever off limits to any dams. The single cooperative achievement since the Marysville summit meeting a decade and a half earlier was the erection of the new Maloney's Dam on the Stanislaus River. There, the Marysville formula was finally tried. The Corps built the dam. The Bureau gets to market the water, if it can. By 1985, 7 years after the dam was completed, not a teacup of New Maloney's water had been sold, which was especially infuriating to those who despaired at watching the last wild stretch of the lower Stanislaus River drowned. One reason no water had been sold was lack of demand, no matter what the Bureau said about demand being there. The other reason was that no canals had been built to carry water from the reservoir to the farmers' fields. Why had they not been built? The conspiracy theorists, who by now include a lot of people who have watched the progress of California water politics from the loser's side, thought they had an answer. As long as New Maloney's water remains unsold, it simply runs out, in carefully regulated and fully usable flows, to the Delta, where it can be sucked up by the state water project's battery of 10,000 horsepower pumps and conveyed either to the big San Joaquin growers or to Los Angeles. It is hard to argue with people who insist that this was the intention all along. The relatively small yield from behind New Maloney's dam, however, is scarcely enough to supply the Chandler family's Tejon Ranch or to satisfy 2 years' worth of subdivision growth in Southern California. As a result, the state water project seems destined to remain chronically undersupplied unless Californians do a remarkable about-face and approve $10 billion or $20 billion worth of new water development. The state, the Bureau, and the Corps have all heaped blame on environmentalism and selfish Northern Californians for the fact that so little has been built. But if anyone was selfish, it was the Bureau and the Corps, who coveted too much and cooperated too little for their own good. As for Pat Brown and Bill Warren and the California Water Lobby, they appear to have schemed themselves into a dry hole. No one will ever know how many ill-conceived water projects were built by the Bureau and the Corps simply because the one agency thought the other would build it first. What is clear, thanks to long-hidden files from the Bureau that have come to light, is that the Corps of Engineers has kept a full court press on the Bureau since it moved on the Kings and Kern Rivers 40 years ago. And it was during this period that by far the most objectionable projects were built. On May 19, 1962, memorandum from Bruce Johnson, the Bureau's regional director in Billings, Montana, to Floyd Dominey offers a vivid illustration of how far things could go. Johnson's memo discussed a series of potential conflicts between the Bureau and the Corps in the Upper Missouri Basin. One project which the Corps was talking about building at the time was Bowman Haley, a dam on the Grand River in North Dakota, which is not much of a river, despite its name. "They will build Bowman Haley if they get the money," Johnson warned Dominey. "I predict the state will see to it that they get the money, unless steps are taken to have the Secretary of the Interior, that is the Bureau, authorized to build it." Would it make sense for the Bureau to build it in that case? "We have reported on Bowman Haley always unfavorably at various times for some 30 years, Johnson wrote. "If we take this on, we will be building another tributary dam with little to show in the way of repayment contracts. Benefits and repayment are based on a delivery of 3,000 acre-feet per year. However, some years delivery of this amount of water will not be possible." It was, in short, a perfectly miserable reclamation project, a project whose yield was not only pitiable, but impossible to guarantee. But it made no better sense, Johnson quickly added, for the Corps to build the dam instead. Flood control was a poor justification. The dam site was so near the river's headwaters that most of the floods were raised downstream. That left municipal water supply as a sole conceivable justification. "But most of the municipal and industrial water supply benefits," he continued, "are anticipatory of urban and industrial growth." And not only was North Dakota the one state in the Union that was losing population, but the little town of Haley, the town that would presumably get the water, is so small, it wasn't even listed in the American Automobile Association's Road Atlas for 1976. The water might be piped to Bowman, a considerable distance away, but even Bowman, a relative metropolis, had only 1,300 people. If the dam were justified on the basis of local water supply, then, it would give Bowman and Haley about 2.5 acre-feet per person, 12 times as much water as average per capita use. It was difficult to conceive of a more worthless project, but in the 1950s and 1960s, projects as dubious as Bowman Haley had a way of getting built. The agency that ended up building it was, indeed, the Corps of Engineers. Authorized by Congress in 1962, Bowman Haley was finally completed 8 years later. Seeing it there, on a piddling river snaking through the drought-bleached rises and swales of western North Dakota, one needn't be a hydrologist or an engineer to fathom why Bruce Johnson was right. The dam itself is huge, more than a mile across and 79 feet high from the base. It has nearly half the bulk of the smaller of the Corps' mainstem Missouri dams. The reservoir, by contrast, is tiny and shallow, a puddle as reservoirs go. It holds only 19,780 acre-feet, while the smallest of the mainstem Missouri reservoirs holds 90 times more. A lot of tax money had gone for a thimble full of water. The Bureau's main problem throughout the Missouri Basin, Johnson added in a footnote to his secret memorandum to Dominey, was the indefatigable opportunism of the Corps of Engineers. They, the Corps, will build projects that we may find unacceptable from a financial standpoint. The states are aware of this. The Corps will gladly give us their bad project proposals on the tributaries, but do not intend to refuse Congress if money is appropriated to build either good ones or bad ones. I do not think they believe that the memorandum, an informal division of responsibility Johnson and his counterpart in the Corps had recently signed, ends the historic game of the states playing the Army against the Bureau to get what is locally desired. It was an incredible admission, although it was obviously not intended as such, since neither the Corps nor the Bureau would assert publicly that any federal water project anywhere had ever been a waste of tax dollars. As Johnson intimated, however, the ultimate blame for the bad projects had to be laid at the feet of the local interests, the contractors and irrigation farmers and patriotic Chamber of Commerce types who haven't the slightest compunction about wasting the taxpayers' money on pointless dams. A perfect example was offered by the Bureau's area engineer in Salem, Oregon, John H. Mangan, who wrote a confidential letter, what the Bureau calls a blue envelope letter, dated January 22, 1965, to Harold Nelson, the regional director in Boise, recalling a conversation he recently had with a member of the Oregon State Water Resources Board. He expressed his feeling, Mangan wrote, that the Corps of Engineers working through the Public Works Committee did not have the difficulties reclamation has. He did not feel that the Public Works Committee was concerned with legislation such as Public Law 9032 of the last Congress relative to reimbursement of recreation and fish and wildlife functions. Mangan said he told the man that any such environmental protection provisions would likely apply to the Corps as much as to the Bureau. But his derisive response, according to Mangan, was that he should watch what happened during the upcoming congressional session. If the Corps is able to secure rapid authorization of a number of projects, and the Bureau is having trouble getting their projects authorized by the Interior and Insular Affairs Committee, the man said, perhaps we should have the Corps building all our projects. Harold Nelson forwarded Mangan's letter to Floyd Dominey, adding a postscript of his own. He had just spoken confidentially with the head of a local pressure group organized to support a new project in eastern Oregon. Nelson's confidant, a Mr. Courtright, said he was finding considerable sentiment that the group should switch its allegiances and push for rapid authorizations by the Corps instead. Courtright stated quite frankly that the argument which they are having the greatest difficulty to counter is the one that authorization through channels available to the Bureau will be much more difficult and time-consuming than through Public Works Committee channels. Actually, Courtright told Nelson, he knew the real cause of the Bureau's difficulties. He attributes them to field representatives of the Oregon Water Resources Board and to the Corps of Engineers itself. As Harold Nelson intimated, an unholy alliance of local economic interests and a powerful member of Congress was something the Bureau was at pains to resist. In 1967, the Johnson administration, preoccupied with the war in Vietnam and the chronic inflation Johnson's policy was creating, requested only a minuscule appropriation for Auburn Dam in California. Robert Pafford, the regional director, wrote a memo to Dominey discussing the options the Bureau had. The obvious one was to slow down the construction schedule on the dam itself. But this was quite inconsistent with the urgent needs for flood control and power. Another was temporarily to stop work on the irrigation and conveyance facilities, the Forest Hills development and the Auburn-Folsom South Canal. However, Pafford wrote, Congressman Biz Johnson has made it quite clear that he wants Forest Hills moved rapidly, and I'm sure you know how unhappy the East Side Association, the main local pressure group, is that we are not moving the Folsom South Canal even faster. They and neighboring Congressman Bernie Sisk would react violently if we cut the canal out in fiscal 1967. Pafford proposed a more palatable alternative. Our soundest course will be to reprogram Auburn funds internally to handle the urgently needed pre-construction program and reduce our right-of-way program accordingly. By reducing land acquisition from $900,000 to $135,000, we will be able to carry out a pre-construction program suitable to Denver's needs for design data. This will provide for some additional land acquisition, although not nearly as much as would be desirable. The remarkable thing about this suggestion was that, first of all, it scorned the will of Congress, which had specifically allocated money for land acquisition and expected it to be used that way. Secondly, its effect could only be to put the squeeze on landowners who sat in the path of the reservoir. It was critical to keep the land acquisition program moving because of the rapid inflation in California land values. But now, Pafford was proposing to do that with 1/7 of the money the Bureau had deemed necessary. This could only mean that people would be offered less money to sell out and might well accede, since the Bureau could always hold the threat of condemnation over their heads. But it was typical of the way the Bureau operated. If it had a cash flow problem, the losers would be the people who had had the bad judgment to own property in the valleys it wanted to flood with its reservoirs. One might be tempted to feel a little sorry for the Bureau of Reclamation. It was, after all, operating at a great disadvantage compared to the Corps, which was unencumbered by social legislation and ostensibly built its reservoirs with the holiest of motives in mind, controlling floods. The available evidence also suggests that the Bureau was not quite as committed to self-perpetuation and self-promotion, nor as inclined to trample its opposition. Under several Interior Secretaries, Ickes, Udall, Andrus, even Nixon's Walter Hickel, it had environmental constraints imposed on it that the Corps needn't have bothered with. But one's sympathies might be tempered if one were told that the Bureau, over the intense opposition of a local town, and on a pristine stretch of river up for inclusion in the wild and scenic river system, was perfectly capable of proposing a dam which, by its own admission, was completely useless. The fact that the Yellowstone River was one of the 4 or 5 remaining rivers of any size in the American West without a single major dam on it had made it attractive to the Bureau since the 1920s. At one point, according to a former director of the National Park Service, Horace Albright, it had even toyed with the idea of damming the river's outflow from Yellowstone Lake and turning the jewel of Yellowstone Park into a regulated reservoir. And Albright had ordered his rangers to take the drastic step of hiding the Park Service boats so the Bureau couldn't come in and survey. The original Pick Sloan plan included a dam lower down on the Yellowstone, which is a major tributary of the Missouri, but in 20 years of trying, the Bureau hadn't been able to justify it. The farmers along the river had already built a number of small-scale diversion projects without the Bureau's help. There was plenty of irrigation going on. Flood control wasn't a good enough reason either, since the damaging floods were all on the lower Mississippi, and by the 1960s the Corps had that river completely under control. Power potential didn't amount to much, weighed against the cost of a dam. By 1965, the river had survived 6.5 decades of the Bureau and nearly 2 centuries of the Corps without being dammed, a noteworthy feat of sorts. At about the same time, the conservation movement awoke to the fact that a river of great beauty and substantial size still flowed wild through the northern Rockies and plains, and began to push for official protection in the wild and scenic rivers system. There seemed to be no earthly reason for the Bureau to resist such status, but it did. the person assigned to take a last long look at the Yellowstone River, in the light of the conservationists' effort, was dour, impassive Gil Stamm, a future commissioner who had just been promoted to assistant commissioner by the man he admired and had served so well. In a long blue envelope letter to Dominey, dated February 3, 1965, Stamm delivered his report. In general, Stamm wrote, no storage regulation in the Yellowstone River is required, as Yellowtail Dam, now under construction, will provide regulation of the Bighorn River, and this will ensure dependable supplies of water below the mouth of the Bighorn, where most of the irrigation was. The only residual interest the Bureau could rightfully claim was to provide electric power and flood control to the city of Livingston. The problem was compounded by the fact that the mission site, where the dam was originally planned, was now occupied by several miles of Interstate 90, which went right along the river below Livingston. Relocating the highway would cost more than it was worth. That left three other sites to select from, the best of them, in beautiful Yankee Jim Canyon above Gardner, Montana, would backwater into Yellowstone Park. Stamm decided to rule it out. The Wanakan site was more expensive to develop, and therefore can barely show a benefit-cost ratio of 1-to-1. That left the Allenspur site, which was practically in the town of Livingston. There is intense local opposition to storage on the upper Yellowstone, and particularly the Allenspur site, Stamm cautioned. The dam would be very close to Livingston, in effect inundating valuable farm and ranch properties, and a reach of outstanding stream fishing with national reputation. Both ranchers and conservationists have expressed strong opposition to any storage development above the town of Big Timber, which is about 35 miles downstream from Livingston. Findings of the Bureau of Sport Fisheries and Wildlife and the National Park Service show that a dam and reservoir in this area would be detrimental to both fishery and outdoor recreation. The reservoir, Stamm said, would inundate 30 miles of Class I trout fishery, 8% of the outstanding trout habitat left in Montana. On top of that, it would create an ideal habitat for goldeneye, a rough fish highly competitive with trout. There was a definite threat of eventual invasion of the streams of Yellowstone National Park by this generally unwanted fish. As if that were not enough, Stamm said that a single-purpose flood-control reservoir at Allenspur, which is essentially what the Bureau was left with, would cost more than presently estimated benefits. Designing it as a power project wouldn't help. If the power were to be evaluated realistically in the light of present-day power values, Allenspur power would not be very attractive. But adding a hydroelectric plant might be necessary to win authorization, because the only support for the potential project is from a few public power supporters. In short, a miserable project, without irrigation benefits, without worthwhile power benefits, without demonstrable flood control benefits, certain to ruin a long reach of the most productive trout river in the West, if not the entire country, and opposed by virtually everyone who stood to benefit from it, for once, by ranchers and conservationists alike. On top of this, an expensive project, projected to cost at least $128 million, say $500 million today. Stamm's letter reads like an argument for giving the upper Yellowstone wild and scenic status. A conservationist couldn't have said it much better himself. But would the Bureau make such a recommendation? Would it at least not oppose such a recommendation? Only if it was allowed to build the Allenspur Dam. Future events, such as a disastrous local flood, possibly could change local attitudes, Stamm concluded. Therefore, his recommendation to Dominey was that the Bureau try to get the Wild River determination altered to accommodate the potential future construction of the Allenspur unit. By doing so, it would ensure that all foreseeable desirable future water resource developments would be protected. The Bureau was prepared to accept wild and scenic river status for the Yellowstone, in other words, as long as it could someday build a dam that would largely destroy it as a wild and scenic river. Behind such nearly pathological unwillingness to let go of even one river stood, of course, the lurking shadow of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. The only conceivable justification for a dam on the Yellowstone was flood control. For now, the Bureau held the authorization to build the project. If it demurred, the Corps might waste no time in trying to build it instead. If, by the late 1960s, the rivalry between the Bureau and the Corps of Engineers had degenerated into an ongoing squabble over needless projects instead of necessary ones, if each agency was reaching farther afield from its original mandate, the Bureau now talking about building a single-purpose flood control dam, the Corps incessantly trying to steal the loyalty of the Bureau's irrigation constituency, if they were trying to move into geographic territory where they had no business being, the Bureau into the swamps of Louisiana, there are internal memos suggesting that even this wet state should perhaps be brought into the Bureau's orbit per request of Senator Russell Long, the Corps into the middle of the Central Valley Project service area. If all of this was true, then it was entirely fitting that the climactic battle between the Bureau and the Corps should be fought in, of all places, Alaska. On April 7, 1961, Darrell Roberts, the head of the Bureau's Alaska District Office, wrote a blue envelope letter to Commissioner Dominey, reporting on a luncheon conversation he had just had with C.W. Snedden, the publisher of the Fairbanks Daily News Miner. Snedden, Roberts wrote, had told him that the Corps of Engineers was cutting my throat and brainwashing the local people in favor of Rampart Dam. Snedden reported that the Corps had held two meetings with the City Council, had met with the Chamber of Commerce, the National Resource Committee, and others to sell them on holding off on the Devil's Canyon project until the Corps completes their Rampart study. This news had so upset Roberts that he made a proposal to Dominey that in all likelihood no one had ever made before. The Bureau should enlist the same conservationist who had just defeated one of its most beloved dams, Echo Park, in a joint effort to make war on the Corps of Engineers. What was ironic about the Bureau and the Corps staging their climactic battle in Alaska was that, strictly speaking, neither of them had any business being there. Alaska has very little agriculture. About the only place one can grow anything is in Matanuska Valley, north of Anchorage, and its few farmers employ little irrigation, if any. Besides, the state has more groundwater than one can dream of, most of it a few feet beneath the surface of the earth. The only navigable inland waterway is the Yukon River, and what the Corps was proposing to build would have put an end to that. Anchorage, Fairbanks, and the tiny towns along the Yukon sit on bluffs. Only once did Fairbanks have a serious flood, and the city was expanding up the hill, away from the Tanana River. Irrigation, flood control, navigation, none of those applied. Yet those were the principal assignments of the Bureau and the Corps. Everything else, recreation, power, fish, and wildlife enhancement, was supposed to be incidental to those activities. In Alaska, however, such incidental benefits were the only rationale they could come up with to build dams, and the dams they wanted to build were too monumental to pass up. The Corps' dream project, Rampart Dam on the Yukon River, was, at last, an opportunity to show the world what it could really do. It wasn't its size that was so breathtaking, although with a speculative height of 530 feet and a length of 4,700 feet, it had the dimensions of Grand Coulee, as the size of the reservoir that would form behind it. Lake Rampart would become the largest reservoir in the world. It would cover 10,800 square miles, making it almost exactly the size of Lake Erie. And it was the power, 5 million kilowatts of it, 2.5 times more than the initial output of Grand Coulee. Rampart was, by far, the grandest virgin hydroelectric dam site under the American flag. There were only a dozen like it in the entire world. The Bureau's project, Devil's Canyon Dam on the Susitna River, was, by contrast, almost invisible. But it was still huge, a high plug in a great canyon on the river which ranked 16th in the United States in terms of annual flow. Devil's Canyon would produce hundreds and hundreds of megawatts of power, depending on how high it was built. In Alaska, it was second only to Rampart as a hydropower site. The Biro's Dam would drown Devil's Canyon, a remote stretch of almost unbelievable wildwater rapids about 100 miles north of Anchorage. Even fish couldn't navigate those rapids, and no sane person would try, although in the mid-1970s, a group of kayakers led by Dr. Walt Blackadar, a 53-year-old surgeon from Salmon, Idaho, did, and succeeded, at least in the sense that none of them died. Devil's Canyon's value was mere spectacle, even if it was the greatest spectacle of whitewater on the North American continent. Rampart Dam, however, was an ecological disaster probably without precedent in the world. It would drown the entire Yukon Flats, a sightless plain of marshes, bogs, and small shallow lakes that nurtures more ducks than all of the United States below the Canadian border. In its report on the project, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service stated, "Nowhere in the history of water development in North America have the fish and wildlife losses anticipated to result from a single project been so overwhelming. At least 1.5 million ducks were contributed to the North American flyways by the Yukon Flats, besides 12,500 geese, thousands of swans, an estimated 10,000 little brown cranes, eagles, sandhill cranes, osprey, and moose, thousands and thousands of moose, to which such boggy habitat was pure paradise. The ducks, the moose, the geese, and the swans all require drowned lands, shallow wet habitat, and the Yukon Flats were the greatest continuous expanse of it in North America. There were salmon. More than 250,000 salmon pass through Rampart Canyon every year, some of them destined to go through 2 time zones to spawning tributaries all the way across Alaska and into Canada. A high dam would end their migration irrevocably. The Corps' plan to lift them out and carry them across the 250-mile reservoir in barges wouldn't help, because the tiny fry couldn't possibly navigate such a vast body of slack water on their way back to the sea. There were also fur-bearing animals. Wolverines, lynx, weasels, martens, muskrat, otter, mink, beaver. Animals which were the livelihood, to greater or lesser degrees, of most of the Yukon people. Some 40,000 pelts, according to the Fish and Wildlife Service, could be taken from the area to be covered by the reservoir on a sustained yield basis every year. And there were people, 1,200 of them in the taking area, another 8,000 or 9,000 whose livelihoods would be drastically affected by either the drowning of animal habitat or the end of the salmon runs. Many of those people were Canadian citizens. Many others were American Indians and Eskimos who had been promised by treaty a land that could sustain them forever. The Corps was promising jobs building the dam, jobs in the tourist industry, jobs in the lake trout fishery that was supposed to replace the salmon. Those were promises. What was already there had sustained their ancestors for 500 generations. The whole idea behind Rampart Dam was to turn Alaska, overnight, into an industrial subcontinent. 5 million kilowatts were enough to heat and light Anchorage and 10 other cities its size, with power left over for a large aluminum smelter, a large munitions plant, a couple of pulp and paper mills, a refinery, perhaps even a uranium enrichment facility tucked safely away in the wilderness, and even then, about half of the power would be left over for export. But that was the problem. Export where? The dam made sense only if all of the power could be immediately sold. Realistically speaking, the dam made no sense at all. Neither did Devil's Canyon Dam. The last thing Alaska had to worry about was an energy crisis. It had 300,000 inhabitants. Its population could fit inside a few square blocks of Manhattan. Even then, before the gigantic North Slope oil field was discovered, it had proven oil reserves estimated at 170 million barrels. The North Slope was to increase the figure by some 10 billion more. It had 360 million board feet of timber. The driftwood floating down the Susitna River seemed enough fuel to fulfill Anchorage's needs. It had, right around Anchorage, some of the most dramatic tidal variations in the world. The difference between high and low tide approached 20 feet, and a single-title project taking advantage of similar conditions at Durance, France, was producing hundreds of megawatts, more than Anchorage, which held half of Alaska's population, would need for decades. Mainly, though, it had plenty of smaller hydroelectric sites scattered about, some of them practically at Anchorage's doorstep. They should be developed first. That was the orderly water development the water planners were always talking about. The problem was simply that Alaska might have to build those itself. Behind their fiercely independent stance, Alaskans in the 1960s were a people completely dependent on Washington, D.C. Their major industry, after fishing, was the U.S. military. Their third major industry was the rest of the U.S. government. Alaskans spoke of their state as a colony, but as colonies go, they had themselves a pretty good thing, and they exhibited all the character traits of colonial people, which is to say that they wanted to exploit their resources for themselves, but expected the federal government to pay the cost. Senator Ernest Gruening, formerly a governor of the state, was the main booster of Rampart. He lobbied for it with a zeal that bordered on the fanatic. Behind him were pressure groups like Yukon Power for America, or the more picturesque North of the Range Association, which said in its brochures that Alaska's future depended on coming forward with both guns blazing. What mattered most to the boosters was that Rampart was an opportunity, the first real opportunity, to leave mankind's mark on a place that held it in magnificent contempt. George Sundborg, Gruening's administrative assistant, dismissed the area to be drowned by the dam as practically worthless. There were not more than 10 flush toilets in it. Gruening went further. It was totally worthless. The Yukon Flats, he wrote, a mammoth swamp, from the standpoint of human habitability, is about as worthless and useless an area as can be found in the path of any hydroelectric development. Scenically, it is zero. In fact, it is one of the few really ugly areas in a land prodigal with sensational beauty. And since these were the 1960s, and since this was the army that wanted to build a project, there may have been a further consideration working behind Rampart Dam. Ernest Gruening had, he said, recently returned from Russia, where he had seen hydroelectric power dams larger than the largest in America. The dam, then, was to be a monument against communism, and if it made it any easier to build it, one might as well note that the ducks whose habitat would be drowned were communist ducks. Many of them migrated to Siberia. Did it make sense, a director of Yukon Power of America asked, to mollify these feathered defectors? It is hard to judge whether or not he was serious. It is also hard to say, in retrospect, how close Rampart Dam ever came to being built. The odds are moderately close, but Floyd Dominey killed it. If the dam was built, the Bureau would have no future in the last place where there were still plenty of big dam sites left. Congress wouldn't authorize another dam there for decades. The power probably wouldn't be needed for 200 years. That was the argument Dominey used, and used brilliantly. With Stuart Udall's enthusiastic blessing, Dominey had the Bureau turn all of its guns on Rampart Dam, the planning division, the hydroelectric division, the demographics branch. Everyone who had some expertise that could cripple Rampart's chances was enlisted in the cause. In 1967, the Interior Department produced its Rampart Report, a document nearly 100 pages long, complete with appendices and reams of supporting documentation in the files. The report demonstrated that Rampart Power had to be sold immediately, or the project would be a financial fiasco of the first order. But it also showed that the power market projected by the Corps and the local boosters couldn't possibly develop within the state. Not in 20 years, not in 50, perhaps never. Shipped to the nearest market, the Pacific Northwest, the power couldn't possibly sell at competitive prices. The cost of transmission alone would be more than people were paying, more even than nuclear electricity. In the end, Dominey was asked to testify on Rampart Dam, and it was one of the most brilliant performances of his career. Without anger, without malice, he tore the Corps' justification to shreds. Even the pedestrian rhetoric of his successors, of a Gil Stamm or a Keith Higginson, might have demolished Rampart's prospects, but Dominey spared nothing in his presentation. When he was finished, Rampart Dam lay pretty much in ruins. The project surfaced a few more times during the 1970s, then floated under and hasn't been seen since. Devil's Canyon Dam, however, was seemingly dead too, at least as far as the Bureau was concerned. Late in the 1970s, the state of Alaska announced plans to build a dam itself. It will be interesting to see whether it can, without falling into the kind of financial hole that the $18 billion Itaipu Dam dug for Brazil. And there, the irony of the whole long fight between the Bureau and the Corps of Engineers came full circle. Had they really cooperated, as General William Cassidy had stated they would, and must, there is no telling what they might have built. Their rivalry prevailed and grew more intense during one of history's truly unique periods, a time when we had the confidence and the money, and, one might say, the compulsion, to build on a fantastically grand scale. The money invested in the dozens of relatively small projects each agency built, in many cases because the other threatened to build first, would have sufficed to build the great works they insisted were necessary, but which required extraordinary determination, cooperation, and raw political clout in order to be authorized. $50 million here, $80 million there, $100 million here, and soon one was talking about real money. In the 1960s, Dos Rios Dam could have been built for $400 million. Today, it might cost $3 billion or more. A diversion from the Columbia River to the southwest could have been built for $6 billion or so in the 60s, and there was so much surplus energy in the northwest that a few million acre-feet of water removed from a river that dumps 140 million acre-feet into the sea might not have been missed. Today, the cost seems utterly prohibitive, and Washington and Oregon would probably resist the engineers with tanks. The opportunity was there, but the Corps of Engineers and the Bureau squandered their political capital and billions in taxpayers' money on vainglorious rivalry, with the result that much of what they really wanted to build does not now exist, and probably never will. Chapter 7. Dominey. When Emma Dominey, writhing and shrieking, finally evicted her son Floyd, the doctors dumped him on a scale and whistled, "Floyd Engin Dominey, 10 pounds, 4 ounces at birth. Floyd Engin Dominey, larger than life." All of Floyd's siblings were born huge. His brother Ralph weighed 12 pounds. Emma's 6 giant babies were a cross she was to bear through the rest of her life. Her uterus became distended, causing her horrid pain. She developed a nervous condition. Her temper became explosive, her outbursts hysterical. Strong-willed, French-Irish, and beautiful, Emma Mae Dominey was a handful anyway. Charles Dominey and his wife fought day and night. They had what is referred to as a difficult marriage, cemented precariously by children, religion, and a pious wheat belt condemnation of divorce. Life, remembers Floyd, was like living on an earthquake fault. There was never any peace. They fussed and fumed from morning to night. We'd lie awake at night and listen to them tearing into each other. He is 70 when he says this, but his childhood is still a bad memory. You can read it in the turned-down corners of his mouth. I remember what a relief it was to get away from home. It bugged me right through college. When everyone else was having nightmares about missing exams, I was having nightmares that my parents were murdering each other. Hastings, Nebraska is a long way from paradise. Libya in the summer, Siberia in the winter, too wet for the Bureau of Reclamation, too arid for trees. Hard up against the 100th meridian, Hastings occupies America's agricultural DMZ. Neither God nor government has taken it under its wing. Disaster is Hastings' stock in trade, that and dullness. The capriciousness of nature is the one thing that livens that place up, says Dominey. When they aren't talking crop prices or tattling on their neighbors, all anyone talks about is the weather. Hastings is tornado country. One of the few double-funnel tornadoes ever seen was photographed near there. Baseball-size hail country, banshee blizzard country, drought-without-end country. The region's whole economy can be drained by a summer's drought, dashed by an afternoon's hailstorm. The anarchy of nature may be one reason why most of Hastings' residents, Republican or Democrat, dry farmer or irrigation farmer, city dweller or country dweller, devoutly believe that man should exercise as much dominion over the earth as he can. Hastings, Nebraska, birthplace of Floyd Dominey, future commissioner of reclamation. Floyd was headstrong and impulsive, an independent cuss from the beginning. He was an above-average but somewhat uninterested student, and his intelligence was more obvious than evident in his grades. His distinguishing characteristic was self-reliance. Floyd had great confidence in himself. At the age of 11, he could manhandle a neighbor's 2,000-pound Belgian draft horses as if they were a pair of pygmy ponies. He fixed things, ran things, organized things. Other children respected and feared him. To most children, the home is a refuge from a dangerous world. In Floyd's case, it was the other way around. Compared to home, shadowed by gloom and rumbling with thunder, the world was a sunlit place. "I always felt there was a contradiction between my parents fussing and fuming and their Christian piety," he says. "It seemed inconsistent to me. As a boy, I was very moral. I was president of my Sunday school class. I thought money was the root of evil. If someone had offered me a job paying $300 a year for life, I would have taken it. When I first married Alice, I made her take off her lipstick if we went out for the evening. I'm an enigma, even to myself." At 17, Floyd fell in love. Her name was Alice Criswell. She was sweet, demure, and very pretty, a little heroine out of Willa Cather. They met at a state convention. He was master counselor for the Order of De Molay, and she was the Queen of Job's Daughters. Alice's family lived in western Nebraska, near Chapel, a good 200 miles away. Floyd was mad for her, but his father refused to let him borrow the car. Floyd had $30 to his name. He spent 25 of it on a beat-up one-cylinder motorcycle that, with luck, would take him to Alice. "It was a hell of a trip out there. The roads were all dirt in those days. I wore out a pair of boots balancing that one lunger, but I made it. When I got ready to go back home, the damn thing wouldn't fire up. Alice's father looked at it and said, 'Your magneto's shot.' I said, 'Can we fix it?' He spent 2 hours trying, but the son of a bitch was beyond repair. I had to sell it for what I could get, which was $5, and start hitchhiking home. Hitchhike, hell. You hardly saw a car in western Nebraska in those days. I'd walked about 3 miles when I came upon an old guy with his head stuck under the hood of his truck. I said, 'What's the matter?' And I looked in, and I saw that his magneto was shot. Well, in the last 2 hours I'd learned about magnetos. I took his apart, saw right away what was wrong with it, and fixed it then and there. That old geezer was so impressed that he offered me a job on the spot. I never went home again." Floyd and Alice married secretly in Georgia, where Floyd had gone after 2 years at Hastings College to work on a gas pipeline being built across the South. They spent their 3-day honeymoon in Florida. Floyd signed in ahead for 3 days of work, and they took off. A supervisor, his heart warmed by a young couple in love, covered for him. "I was 19, Floyd says. "I think that was the first lie I ever told in my life." When his stint in Atlanta was up, Floyd and Alice went back to Hastings. For $15 a week, he drove a truck between Hastings and Lincoln. Driving anything, a team of horses, was a dream job to many a farm boy, but Floyd found it excruciatingly dull. "I finally said to myself, 'Hell, $15 a week is nothing. I'll go out to western Nebraska with Alice.' I got myself a job on Fred Smith's place. Man, that was a badly run operation. They had new weeding tractors, and their wheat fields were still being run over by weeds. They only ran the tractors during the daytime. They were too lazy to run them at night. This land was dry farmed, and those weeds were using precious rainfall that was needed by the wheat. There were lights on the tractors. They should have been running the goddamn machines 24 hours a day. So I finally said, "This is a hell of a way to run a farm." Fred Smith thought I was quite an upstart. He said to me, "Well, how would you run it?" And I said, "I'll show you." I climbed on one of those tractors and I ran it till 10 o'clock at night. Then I went to bed, got up at 3 in the morning, and finished the job by 4 the next afternoon. Cleared out every weed on that farm. I was hell for leather. I didn't stop to take a leak. Old Fred Smith came up to me later as I was changing clothes and said, "With that kind of drive, you're wasting yourself. You ought to go back to college." The sensible thing for a mechanically gifted farm boy who didn't particularly like farming to major in was engineering. At Hastings College, Dominey had given it a brief go and quit. "I didn't like the preciseness," he says. In 1930, he entered the University of Wyoming at Laramie, choosing economics as a major. He was captain of the hockey team. He stayed on and won a master's degree in 1933. By then, the country's economy was in a screaming nosedive and the West was 5 years into the Great Drought. The ranchers around Laramie couldn't sell their cattle, first, because no one had money to buy them, second, because the cattle weren't worth buying anyway. They were thirsty and starving, vacant-eyed beasts with bellies bloated from hunger and protruding ribs. Stupefied by the intensity of the disaster, Wyoming's people were in the same condition, mentally if not physically. Campbell County, 200 miles north of Laramie, was typical of the places that had plummeted through FDR's safety net of relief. Roosevelt couldn't launch a federal dam project there because Campbell County had no river worth a damn. It had no highway project because no one went there and it hardly had cars. It had no writers' projects, no hospital projects, no dog census. All it had was the cattle liquidation program. The agriculture department's county agent paid the ranchers $8 a head for their scrawny cattle and shot them. The farmers took the $8 and spent it on horse feed and rifle shells, then headed into the uplands in search of deer and rabbits. During the Depression, Campbell County reverted substantially to the hunter-gatherer existence of the Crow and Northern Cheyenne, who had forfeited the territory. The two things it had going for it were reasonably abundant herds of game and the county agent, Floyd Dominey. At 11 o'clock one morning in the spring of 1980, Dominey, floating on 3 gin and juices and powered by 2 cigars, was in a mood to talk about his Campbell County days. "We had a drought. Grasshoppers, crickets. I tell you, it was something else. It looked as if nothing could live. Under the federal regulations, 5,000 cattle were to be bought in the whole state of Wyoming. 50,000 were dying in Campbell County alone. I called up Washington and said, 'This is worse than you can believe. Send me another vet, damn it.' They sent me 3 vets. That got me some attention. The range improvement program, though, really put me on the map. That took creativity and force. The government was paying farmers 15 cents a cubic yard to move dirt. Hell, I wasn't going to pay 15 cents if it cost 10. I said to those ranchers, 'I'm going to pay you cost, nothing more.' Naturally, they bellyached. But with my relief allotment stretched further, I could build a lot more dams." Campbell County is drier than crisp toast, but it does get some rain. There are mountains around that produce orographic clouds, and some of them produce rain, not much, but enough to make it worth trying to store the runoff that occasionally pours down the creeks. I said to myself, "It's stupid to let a drop of that stuff escape. We've got to capture that water." I take these ranches out to where I wanted them to build a dam, some god-awful-looking dry creek somewhere, and they'd say, "A dam's no good. There's no water to take." And I'd say, "God damn it! A 10-minute downpour in this devegetated moonscape and you'll see a nice little surge come through here." The one good thing about Wyoming is there's not enough ground cover to soak up the rain where it falls. I said to the farmers, "You capture that water and at least your cows won't die of thirst. You get a little extra for irrigation and you can grow some grass on it. What do you want to do? Just sit here and starve? So I got them building dams. I practiced myself with a little 4-horsepower Fresno scraper. The county surveyor and I developed our own set of regulations. We said it's got to have 10-foot width and 5 feet of freeboard. The federal regulation said the soil conservation man had to approve the dam site. The Forest Service guy was supposed to have his say-so, too. I said to hell with it. I cut all that red tape. The extension director and the Wyoming dean of agriculture finally got wind of what I was up to. They said to me, Floyd, you can't do that. You've got to play by the rules. I said, the Democrats would have a really black eye if they announce a program that doesn't work. Dominey took a swig of gin and juice, leaned back in his black easy chair, and chuckled. That was the end of prior approval. Henry Wallace took the phrase right out of the law. We built 300 dams in my county. That was more than in the whole rest of the West. I was a one-man bureau of reclamation. We were moving. I was 24 years old, and I was king. Campbell County was my domain. They still talk about me out there. I saved a lot of cattle from dying and a lot of farmers from going on relief. After that, I started getting job offers from Washington. But I had already psychoanalyzed myself as a strong starter who got bored easily. I figured I'd have to watch that if I wanted to succeed in life. So I'd made up my mind to stay in Campbell County 5 years. For Floyd and Alice, the first 2.5 years in Campbell County meant a lifestyle a cut above that of his ancestors when they arrived in Nebraska in 1873. They lived in a stone dugout built into a hillside. They had a gasoline lantern and a coal-burning stove, but no windows. The place had been abandoned for 30 years. It was vandalized. The house had a leaning chimney and big holes in the floor. I was being paid $130 a month, plus 5 cents a mile for the car. The guy who owned the hovel was named Mr. Bartles. He was as bald as a billiard ball. I said, "What's the rent?" He said, "You're crazy wanting to live there in the first place. I'm not going to let you live there and charge you rent." Dominey didn't quite achieve his goal of staying 5 years in Campbell County. He finally succumbed to an offer from the Agricultural Adjustment Administration to help administer the nation's increasingly complex farm program, working as a field agent for the western states. In 1942, he transferred to the Inter-American Affairs Bureau, working under Nelson Rockefeller. The war effort demanded immense quantities of bauxite, rubber, and cinchona, most of it coming out of the Caribbean and South America. Tens of thousands of miners and loggers were dumped in the middle of the jungle without enough to eat. Instant farms became Dominey's specialty. He set them up in 9 Central and South American countries, and later on the islands of Saipan, Tinian, Iwo Jima, and Peleliu as they were recaptured from the Japanese. In March of 1946, Dominey was back from the Pacific. Reviewing his career on a homebound ship, he decided that nothing had been as satisfying as building all those dams in Campbell County. It was one thing to hack a farm out of a jungle clearing. That was brutal and monotonous work, requiring neither brains nor talent. It was quite another thing to build a dam, store the water, and make the desert bloom. That, in a small way, was changing the order of the universe. On the same day he returned to Washington, Dominey went to a phone booth and put in a call to the Bureau of Reclamation. He had a job in 3 hours. As a land development specialist for the Bureau, Dominey proved his mettle quickly. His experience helped, as did his prodigious energy, but Dominey also had something a great many of the Bureau's engineers lacked, a knack with people. It was two things, he says. First, I cared about making these projects work. The engineers would build the dam and the irrigation features and walk away from it. They felt the projects were supposed to work out by themselves. When I got there, we had projects failing all over the place. The Bureau would send a threat out to the farmers to shape up, then forget about them for 5 years. No one took us seriously. Well, by God, they took me seriously. I was tough, but they saw I cared about their problems. That was number two. I proved myself right away. One of our early projects in big trouble was Milk River in Montana. The regional director, Ken Vernon, had revised the repayment contract under political pressure, and it was a complete giveaway. I had moved up to allocation and repayment then, and I sent him a blistering letter about it. Vernon was several ranks above me, and he couldn't believe it.